Watch this. No way!
Hello and welcome back to the Cookie Jar Golf Podcast. I am Tom Mills and today I'm joined by Sam Williams.
Hello.
And Sir Bruce Fitzpatrick.
Hello.
Good day, Bruce. How are we doing, boys?
Bloody hell, sorry. It's just lagged for me a bit there.
It's a bit like the sort of your downswing, isn't it, really? Sort of, is that where you're working on that sort of early neg beta?
Heavy lag. Mm.
Just getting rid of some of that draw bias that we're seeing in the game.
Oh, yeah, actually the opposite. Yeah, oh, okay. The opposite of that. The opposite of lag, Sam. Only a heathen like you would mistake the two concepts.
I thought he was a heathen. Maybe I'm
heathen.
Wrong.
What did I say?
A heathen, like Heathland.
I don't know
like
whether Heathland. It was a little segue into, some of that.
Sandy and acidic diaries, yeah.
Yeah, that sort of stuff. Anyway.
Welcome back to the final podcast of 2020, which has been a long, tiring, interesting year of golf. Wouldn't you agree, chaps?
Yeah, it has, actually. It feels very elongated. Actually, I don't know. I know there's that old adage about, time goes slow when you're really bored, but I wouldn't say it's as simple in this case. It's just, I guess the going through several iterations of lockdown and social distancing guidelines and all that and being cooped up for hours on end, but then also getting out and doing some amazing trips has made it feel like a very strange year and your perception of time. It's an odd one, isn't it?
Bonkers, hasn't it? And we've spent so much time doing this as well. I mean, think by the time this goes out, this will be episode 58. I think we've done 58 pods.
58, yeah.
And we've done I think we did our first in January and then left it like 3 or 4 weeks and kind of let it marinate, kind of kicked on with it. And then when lockdown happened, we just kind of went into overdrive on everybody's DMs and seeing who we could speak to, and it's just kind of snowballed, isn't it? But it's nuts when you think, like, in a year we've done 58 pods. Without that, I'd spend an awful lot more time with my wife and child. Some would argue that'd be a good thing. My wife probably wouldn't. It's been absolutely crazy, hasn't it? And I guess kind of good opportunity to take stock and look back at some pretty cool moments. But just put something up on Instagram and sort of said, like, big thank you for everyone's support this year. I mean, it is a weird thing doing podcasting because, you are just really talking to an empty room, or you certainly feel like you are for the first 20 or 30 episodes. And it's really cool when we get people reaching out to us and kind of enjoying what we're doing, and kind of feels like we're finishing 2020 on a bit of a high, really. So, and that's not really us. That's kind of everyone who listens and watches and hopefully enjoys the stuff that we wax on about all year.
Well, when like you're learning to play a musical instrument and then you look back at a video when you've just picked it up for the first time and you're strumming along and you can't play and it sounds shit, but you're loving it and you think that everybody else is loving it. I mean, throw back to January 4th, episode 1. Christ, we were strumming and had no idea
what
we were
doing. Is that why the episode is now about 7.5 minutes long? Because you just keep going back.
Just keep cutting shit out of it
and editing garbage out of it. Weirdly, the pilot episode is one of the most downloaded, because I think people just, I want to pick it up from episode 1. And I think,
so we're like, please don't.
Yeah. Just going around about 15, something like that, please. Yeah.
But it was a crazy journey. I mean, that very first podcast, we started literally with the concept of, can we get this on the internet? Like, the content at that point didn't matter. It was like, we're sat in my garage, and are we able to physically put something down in a recording and put it up on the internet? And I think Sam came along, and I said to him, afterwards, I was like, that's up on Spotify. And he was like, right, you need to take that down pretty quickly. I can't even remember what we talked about.
I can't. I don't know what it was. About an hour, wasn't it? But it's now about 15 minutes long. I can't remember.
Oh, on the pilot. See, I wasn't part of it, so I can remember it fairly well. I can remember bits of it. It's kind of linger in the memory when you boys, because I mean, how long ago was it? We were sat in the stud bar at Blackwell, you know, talking about the idea of doing a podcast and whether it seemed a bit too self-indulgent, whether anyone actually listened to it. And then next thing I know, you boys messaged me saying, yeah, we've had a go at it. Episode one's now live. And I mean, Sam just kind of regaling the audience of one at that point with stories of him, you know, managing to compress a 35-hour working week into 3.5 days, I think was his exact line, and saying how he's having a few glasses of wine at lunch and going out and striping some balls, and I'm down to 4 now, and all this kind of, you know, self-indulgent,
all of this, but, is probably very, very the reason funny. Bruce, a lot of it's shortened that pilot episode, so thanks for bringing that up again.
But it was fun. Yeah, I mean, and then from there,
well, exactly, from small acorns and all that. So how are we doing this, Tom? I thought we're going to, what, talk a little bit about cookie jar highlights from 2020, talk about highlights from the golfing world in 2020. Be nice to sandwich in some year-end appraisals as well. I kind of think it'd be a good opportunity to do.
Yeah, performance reviews.
Yeah, we're going to throw in a few thank yous to people that have helped us along the way, and just a bit of an outline on what, how we've done and what we've enjoyed about this year, and then maybe dip into the tour a bit and what's been good going on 2020. But I mean, like you say, from small acorns, it was the 22nd of March that was our first guest, Sam Clapham,
England Golf,
here in this garage, just came along and indulged us in our terrible chat. And that was, I mean, that was a precursor to Lucas, which our first real player. And I mean, from those people giving us a punt, really, like, I can't honestly thank these people enough for giving us their time, because let's be honest, we're a set of jokers, aren't we?
Well, we certainly were then, probably are now in most people's opinion, aren't we? But who have we got? There's people, a lot of people we reached out to. I guess my memory would be people like Iona Stephen. I think leaning heavily on a St. Andrews story through the Lucas pod, and sort of trying to corral some favour there in an email saying, oh, I've got this guy on, he sort of hit a ball out of McIntosh Hall onto the 18th green, seemed to just about sort of get her on. We had a really good time chatting with her. And I guess that's the nature of the beast, isn't it? I know it's, to some people, you'd be like, oh, it's a bit, you know, is it a bit self-serving to go out and try and find a lot of guests? But the nature of podcasting and the volume of podcasts out there, you know, it's really important to bring on high quality guests. One, because it's really interesting for people, but also two, it really does help promote that to a wider listener base, which when we're starting off with I think, you know, our early pods getting about half a dozen downloads in the first week.
That was tough. That was tough days, wasn't it?
It's a slog, isn't it? I can only, it is like learning an instrument from scratch and you can't play a scale and, you know, nothing works and stuff. So,
and you're trying to sell it to people. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, people like Gio Valiante and Tom Coyne, the author, who, you know, a lot of these people, I mean, Christ, of all the people we've had on the pod, Lucas Michel seems to have done every podcast in the world now, not just golf, but he's definitely found his initial fame on podcasting with us, I'd like to think. And a lot of these people who've got loads of offers and loads of stuff coming in, you know, are now kind of, you know, giving about their time. I thought that was awesome.
I mean, yeah, like when you've got people like Lucas or Iona or Tom Coyne, and we're kind of reaching out to them with a bit of a Hail Mary saying, I know we're only kind of 4 episodes or 6 episodes in or whatever we were by that point, but do you fancy coming on the podcast and chatting things through? It was just, yeah, I mean, those are exactly the kind of breaks you need in the kind of human decency and generosity that anyone needs, I guess, to get started and to look back at, you know, how we interviewed them back then when we were perhaps a little bit, you know, wet behind the ears, so to speak, and how much we've kind of, you know, moved on since then and been able to just kind of get this thing snowballing a little bit, going into stuff like, you know, the video as well, which I guess some people would say is maybe a more natural fit given your professionalism in that area, Tom. But it's just brilliant to see how, in many ways, the golfing world is actually quite small and quite connected, and everyone kind of looks after one another.
But I thought it'd be interesting for us to talk about some of our favourite stories that have come up on the pod. And I think naturally for me, Lucas is a really, it's a great one. That story, and we're going to cut to a little clip in a moment, but that story of him hitting 7 irons is just one of the ones I think that really yeah. really landed with me as something that I thought, yeah, this is something I want to continue. But let's roll into that Lucas clip and see, and let you remind you guys from episode 10.
Basically, the window was only about, I think it was about 2 feet, yeah, probably 2 feet high, but it was probably 3 feet wide. So it was a tiny little window, and that was the most it could open up to. And then there was a little metal barricade, like, that was used for, like, hanging towels and stuff. And I had to unscrew that. I think I borrowed a screwdriver from Brucey, actually.
Well, yeah, we went to mine and we got the toolbox out, didn't we? You like you needed some something to hang your suitcase.
I don't
like,
believe Bruce has a toolbox.
To make sure that it didn't, like, in case you caught it high on the face, it wouldn't hit, like, the window. So it was, there was quite a lot of thought and detail that went into this.
But, to explain exactly what went down, so I'd figured out the exact height that it needed to come out of the window based on a bit of maths and engineering that Bruce and I figured out. So I knew that I needed to be, I think it was like 2 and a bit club lengths of a 7-iron away from the window so that it would come out of the right trajectory to get through the window and then make the distance to the 18th green. So I waited until it would have been at least midnight or around midnight, I'd say. And I'd had probably, I didn't want to drink too much, but I had like a pint just to settle the nerves.
Yeah.
Good master's prep.
And then invited a select few of people. So it wasn't too rowdy. There was a few people in the room. I think there was a few people on FaceTime to a few other people that were standing nearby the green. And I hit multiple shots, actually. Well, two shots that successfully made it out the window and then one that actually ricocheted within and made a little bit of a dent on the...
So the first one you caught thin, didn't you? Was that... Do you reckon... I mean, that's probably the most nervous you've been over a golf ball was that first 7-iron, you say?
Well, the problem was if I caught it, if it came out higher than I expected, it was hitting glass. But if it came out lower than I was expecting, it was hitting wood framing, like timber frame. So I think, my preference was to catch it a little thin and I caught it a bit too thin and it went straight into the bit of, thankfully it was a thick bit of wood surrounding the windowsill and it kind of just bounced around and left a bit of a mark, but nothing too major.
Well, we had to get toothpaste for it. Do you remember? Like, an hour or so later, it was like this white wooden panel, and oh, like we were filling it in with like toothpaste to try and make sure there's no. Picking up all the wood chippings. But then I'm pretty sure you made two good pars with the other two shots, didn't you?
I did. Yeah.
So the other two got down on the green.
So the first one was actually at the back left. I suppose if it's. If you're playing the hole, it's the left edge, but from my angle, sort of perpendicular to the way the hole's actually played, it was the back edge for me. So it actually went a little too far. I think that didn't account for the amount of slope downhill it was. But then the second one, I think I changed clubs to an 8-iron for the second one that made it out successfully, and that was sort of pin high, but a little left. So I went down there. I'm forgetting the part where the hall manager knocked on my door and wondered what the hell I was doing. which thankfully we hit all the golf clubs and they thought we were just moving furniture or dropping furniture or something like that. Thankfully, they didn't suspect it was golf. And then we went downstairs and I two-putted for a 3.
That was a stellar story. I remember recording that pod and Bruce coming around was like, I spoke to Lucas, he's definitely going to drop this story. Because I don't think it had been heard at that point. And
I remember being there live at the time and just being like, watching this thing live and being like, this is the stuff of absolute legend. And I was just thinking, we absolutely have to tell this story to people because it is exactly what I guess people would dream of when they think of what's it like being a golfer as a student at the University of St. Andrews.
And that's the great thing about Cookie Jar as well. And it goes full circle because, feeding off his adulation going into the Masters in April, then finding out that got cancelled, then kind of picking up with him after he played the US Open at Wingfoot, watching him go into the US Masters, all that stuff was just, it was awesome then because it like sets it as a bit of a journey almost with him for the year. And that was just, it was such a cool story, wasn't it? I mean, it's got to be one of the all-time stories of the pod.
Oh, it's brilliant, isn't it? Bruce, what's the standout stories that come out of the pod this year for you?
I think, okay, I'm going to go off tag a little bit here. I think the Yarwood one was bloody good fun, actually, with you, Mills.
I wasn't on this one. I remember you guys ringing me after it.
Yeah, I remember just going into it being like, okay, this is a guy who looks like a really sort of professional coach who's you know, worked with some of the best players in the world, and he'd have some fantastic stories to tell, and his Instagram profile's really polished, and oh, you know, he's a Ledbetter guy by training, so I bet he's going to tell some fantastic stories. And just not being able to get a word in edgeways, number one, was because this guy was just full steam ahead, probably at 7 o'clock in the morning.
It was also like 6 or 7 in the morning for him at the time.
Yeah, the guy's just on it from sort of, you know, minute one. And then also, you know, for the benefit of our listeners, hosting this podcast remotely on a site called Squadcast, and then seeing Jonathan point to some shoes that he had in a cabinet in the background and say, oh, by the way, I know it's not really relevant to the story I was telling, but those shoes are Seve Ballesteros. It's from the 1984. The whole thing was just like, yeah, just anecdotes on speed. Really.
Experience. It sounded like he basically waltzed into Squadcast and just kicked the proverbial saloon doors through with his feet. And just came in firing from the hip, didn't he? I mean, he was
absolutely. Yeah,
classed as just an absolute loose guest. Who, I mean, he just ran it, didn't he, for the duration. Yeah. And
episode 29. I mean, the thing that's gone down in the cookie jar folklore.
Yeah, and one line that I think has just been immortalized by how many times we've repeated it is this one.
Someone once said to me, I'm the best coach no one's ever heard of. And I was quite proud of that, really, because to me, it's not about me. It's about them. It's not about my ego. It's about helping them. And I think too many people do it the other way around. It's too much about them and not enough about the player. So I was quite happy to be in the background and just keep achieving success and just getting good at what I thought was good at what I do. And just kind of went from there. I coached 5 USGA champions. I coached a winner on 7 tours around the world, you know, an amateur number one, a junior number one, you name it. I've kind of been there and done it to some extent. So I've enjoyed going around the world. I've traveled all over the place. Jeez, I've been to 40 or 50 majors. I've coached on almost every continent around the world. And I've gone around the world on someone else's dollar and often in a private jet. So that's pretty good from a county state in Skegness.
Episode 29, Jonathan Yarwood. It was an out of body experience, I think.
Mills, pivoting gracefully to you, what would you say your standout moment from the pod was?
I have two, but there's one really fairly recent, but I'm going to go back for the oldest one first. In my real job of professional videographer, I have certain people that I look up to and respect. And when we had David Cannon on the pod, it was like, this was episode 18. I guess it would be what for you would be Como on the pod, or for Sam, some absolute braggy ball striker. Like listening to him to tell stories, I was just in awe of the guy, because he's just achieved so much and he's done so much. And when he told his story about when he was working for the European team at the Ryder Cup, and he was in Medina when Poulter was going, that's a story that's always going to stick with me. And I think we're going to roll a bit on that.
Well, up till 2 years ago, I was the official photographer for the European team. So they were full on heavy weeks, but I kind of retired out of that role. So I kind of do my own thing now at Ryder Cups, which is photographically, it's brilliant for me. I miss being allowed in the team room and being part of the teams, but I've seen some amazing moments, you know, off the course, let alone on the course in a Ryder Cup.
Yeah, so
it's the most fantastic event, isn't it? I mean, in golfing terms, I think the majors are the pure pinnacles, you know, the Masters, the Open. I think the Open's still the one, is number one for me, and then the Masters photographically, because it's such a beautiful place to take pictures. But all four of them have got so much importance in people's careers, and everything else. But then the Ryder Cup, for some reason, every 2 years is now, and it's global as well. You know, you think because it's not involving the South Africans, the Australians, or whatever, they are absolutely glued to the Ryder Cup.
Yeah. And it, it just seems to produce so much raw emotion.
The pressure. The pressure of playing in that is just, I just cannot imagine some of the shots that those guys hit under pressure is just amazing.
Are there any dressing room stories that are acceptable for a podcast?
Poulter, you know, the Saturday night at Medina was pretty incredible in that locker room, because that locker room had tin lockers. You know, I don't know whether you've been to American country clubs, but some of them still have the old fashioned tin lockers, and the noise in there, the door slamming and the fist pumping, and after he'd done that, you know, that was electric in there. That was an amazing, and then it, obviously on the Sunday night after they'd won in there, was absolutely epic as well. And you know, Ollie was just absolutely totally in tears. You know, he could not speak for about
for several reasons, isn't it? I mean, the comeback alone, but also with the it coming thing. You know, with the Seve sort of legacy and wearing all blue. I'm guessing you were still part of the team photographer at that moment in time. Did you get a sort of sense the night before that you were kind of on the eve of something special?
Well, I think, you know, Poulter lit the touch paper, basically. You know, that last nine holes on the Saturday evening, it was astonishing. And you talk about
having eyes to photograph. He's probably got some of the most distinct eyes. Yeah. They're almost coming out of his head, aren't they?
I was in the wrong spot for that. Most of those moments on that back nine. That's the thing. When you work in a group of photographers, as we do, you know, there were probably six of us, of which four of us were on that match or whatever. You can't be in the same place as another guy. So you have to kind of divide it up. And that all depends where you're walking and how you're setting yourselves up. So you just have to work as a team. But, you know, since I've sort of changed my role a little bit in the last couple of years, I can go back to shooting where I want to, because I'm working individually.
And when you were obviously involved with the European team for Medina, were you part of the concerned when Rory hadn't showed up for his tea time? Has that got round to you?
Yeah, I would have got round to us, because we're all on the radio and they're all saying, Rory hasn't turned up, you know.
That was a bit of a panic, wasn't it?
I kind of knew that he was going to win. And that's one of the best pictures I got from that whole Ryder Cup, was him with an alarm clock hanging around his neck after it all finished. Yeah. And to me, that's just great.
Yeah. And that story for me, I mean, it was very visceral. You can just imagine you were there, and it was just like, so powerful. Like, I don't know, the guy is an absolute legend, and he's such a gentleman as well. Like, he was so giving of his time. And that was one that really stuck out for me.
Cannon kind of sums up a lot of what I think we've done this year really well about Cookie Jar, which is someone who's kind of behind the scenes but inside the ropes. And I think that angle's wicked, because the stuff that's interesting is the lesser covered stories, but through the eyes of people who've got that level of access. So like people like Trotty would be really another, you know, really cool example, because, you know, they're not out there on TV hitting the balls, but they've got all the access and they see it all, and they see the dynamics and they see the stuff happening. And, you know, from someone like David Cannon, who I literally off the top of my head, I couldn't tell you the numbers, but when he talks about it on that pod, it's obscene the number of major tournaments he's been to, the things he's witnessed.
Literally every iconic photograph.
Yeah. And what is brilliant that, you know, for someone who's been there and captured all these amazing moments, he's also just a fantastic storyteller. Like him telling that story of the kind of personal conflict he had when Seve was leading. Well, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, I think he was leading on the back nine of the 86 Masters that Nicklaus went on to win. And having, you know, I think by that point, maybe taken quite a few photos for Seve's clothing line, and obviously developed somewhat of a friendship with Seve, wanting to go and, you know, stay with him and maybe support him, but then realizing there was professionally, you know, he kind of maybe should go and take this photo of Nicklaus, which he ended up doing on the 17th green at Augusta, which has gone down as possibly one of the most iconic moments in major history. And he was the one who captured it. Like, yeah, I just think hearing those stories firsthand and like the kind of internal dilemma he was facing was, yeah, kind of sent shivers down your spine.
Where do you sit on it, Sam? What sticks out for you?
There's tons, aren't there? I mean, these I kind of just jotted down off the top of my head. I've got a really weird memory, which was in the height of summer. I think it was pretty much the hottest day of the year. And I think Bruce had chucked out this idea a few months before saying, 90 years since the Grand Slam, wouldn't it be really cool if we did something with Bobby Jones? And I thought, yeah, that's a really good shout, actually. Like, why don't we track down the best historian we can find on Bobby Jones? And I remember seeing Sid Matthew in some like Sky Sports documentary and being sort of like just in awe of the guy's knowledge about the guy. And I remember we reached out to him. We had this most bizarre sort of pre-meeting, because a lot of the times with our guests on the pod, we'll try and have a meeting with them prior to them jumping on. Now we've got a little bit more refined, or at least we'd like to think so. And Sid joined this like pre-meeting. Do you boys remember? It was the three of us, and there was something there was like a relay on the audio. So everything we were saying to Sid, just talking about what we were trying to do, got played back on our headphones, but not on his, like 10 seconds later. It was honestly the most confusing thing ever, trying to hold a conversation down where you almost had to just, I don't know what the, it's like kind of the talking equivalent of patting your stomach and rubbing your head. And it was just impossible. Anyway, when we finally got around to doing it, Sid jumps on this thing with me and Bruce and goes, look, guys, because we always say, look, how are you guys for time? Are you okay? And Sid's like, yeah, I'm good. It's 5 p.m. here. I can pretty much run till, I don't know, what time? It was like 12 o'clock in the States. He said, I can probably run till about 5 p.m. here. So I'm good for 5 hours. And I was like, okay, it's literally 40 degrees centigrade in Mills' room. Like, I'm already sweating. I've got massive headphones on. We're recording this thing. I'm sweltering. And I think we did about 2.5 hours. And it was unbelievable, the stuff that was pouring out of him, but nowhere near as impressive as the amount of sweat that was pouring off my head as well at the same time. And I just remember that being... It was a really cool episode, wasn't it? It was really cool. But at the same rate, it was like doing something really interesting, but doing it in a sauna at the same time. It's just like a little memory that sticks in my head. But Sid was a quality guest. And kind of just tracking down people with that level of insight on somebody who's, I mean, Sid must have committed thickest end of 30 or 40 straight years just on pure Bobby Jones research. Like, any spare time has been devoted to, you know, this person. It was just incredible, absolutely incredible.
Yeah, and to have that encyclopedic knowledge just on demand with no notes, but to be able to recite, you know, verbatim articles that he'd written, you know, 5-10 years ago was incredible. But yeah, as for the sort of logistical hilarity of it, I distinctly remember you, Sam, getting to the stage with that relay in the preliminary meeting where you had to take the headphones off and actually just put them around your neck so you couldn't hear anything because you weren't able to actually put together a sort of coherent sentence, having the relay of your voice being played back 2 seconds later. And then Sid was trying to jump in and say something, but because you didn't have the earphones on, you were then not able to listen to what you're saying.
It must have been for him like talking to three people who had a cumulative IQ of about 12 who'd managed to write an articulate email to him asking to do something investigative and highbrow Bobby Jones. Yeah. And we literally couldn't string a sentence together between us.
But I distinctly remember there was obviously some wires crossed because I think he thought that first meeting was the podcast. And he was like, oh, we're on podcast. Mm. Cool. So here are some paintings, and he was showing us all these paintings. I mean, like, Sid, it's just audio. I've got some more paintings in the back.
So cool, though. It was such a cool thing today.
Episode 38 and 39, Sid Matthews, Bobby Jones podcast. I mean, here's a little clip, just a small flavor of what this guy can reel off.
So he knew Hoylake, and Hoylake is very playable. And the putter is everything. And he had to go up against, Abe Mitchell, you know, he had to go up against, the top, British players, Compston, Archie, and these guys can bang it out there pretty good. But remember how Tiger played it. He hit the burner 2-iron You know, he can hit it over 300 yards, but he hit the burner two iron to play the angles so that he would have the best putting approach toward the flag. And basically, that's what Bob did. But Hoylake boiled down to the 16th green. 16 has a deep bunkers on both sides. And Bob was in the bunker, but he was on the downhill ledge furthest away from the green. So he had to loft the ball off of that downhill up onto a green that was so keen that they thought that it was only fair that they pour a bucket of water near the hole in between every match. That's how dry it was.
Wow.
Okay.
Can you imagine that?
Yeah. So, fortunately, he played two professional tournaments before before he started his trek overseas, Augusta and Savannah. And he roomed with Horton Smith. Horton gave him a brand new club. It was called a Walter Hagen concave sandwich. And it looks like a soup ladle or a water ladle. And had this big, heavy base to it and a concave face. And Bob crashed down against the descending slope, picked the ball up, lofted it over the lip of the next edge of the bunker. The ball trembled on the edge of the bunker and rolled down and lipped out, finished 4 inches from the cup.
Yeah, it's just incredible stuff, isn't it, with Sid there. The other one I had, just while I'm on a flow here, Gio Valiante sticks in my mind as being, I would almost say, probably my favorite, one of my favorite episodes we've actually done. Just sheerly for the interest and the insight. He's a world class talker. So if you haven't listened to the Gio Valiante pod, I'd probably place that as in the top few of the ones we've done that you like are the must listens to. But I want to talk about it for a couple of reasons. First off, I think I reached out to Gio and got in touch, and he was like, yeah, thanks for reaching out to me. Like, I really appreciate it. 100% I'd like to do it. And I thought, wow, that was easy. This guy's essentially the mental coach to Justin Rose. He's done work with Jack Nicklaus. He's hugely decorated.
Worked with Tiger as well, I think.
Yeah, worked with Tiger and all sorts of stuff. So I was like, wow, I'm so psyched about doing this, because the idea of talking to a mental coach is one that I personally find that more interesting than talking to a swing coach, because it's just so multidimensional. And then I'd say, unfortunately, I was at the hospital then in the morning with my wife, who's giving birth to our son. So our firstborn, which is like massive event for 2020. And that'll stick in my head massively, because I was like, look, you boys have to run with it.
Well, you called him Gio, didn't you?
Yeah, very good. Very good. Very good. Can you imagine that would be
Gio Williams. Strong, Gio, yeah. Valiante Williams.
Gio Valiante Williams.
A strong middle name would have been good.
But yeah, so like you boys ran with it. And I remember like listening to that once it was edited, I think, while I was sort of pacing around the kitchen waiting for the missus to get the all clear to come home. But that was just such a cool podcast, and obviously sticks in my mind as well, just for the timing of it. But yeah, if you haven't already, here's a little snippet.
Because what happens, think of it this way. If your goal in golf is to impress somebody, right? It's not about golf. It's not about playing the game. It's about making an impression on a person. Okay, so let's say you go out in the first hole and you play badly, you make a double bogey or a triple bogey. What emotion are you likely to feel if your goal is to impress someone and you make a triple bogey? What's your emotion going to be?
Pretty pissed off.
I feel pretty shitty.
Embarrassed as well, yeah.
Embarrassed, right?
Embarrassed and angry. So let's talk about anger and embarrassment, which on our profile are two of the bad reactions, embarrassment being the worst. So when you feel embarrassed, there's a part of your brain called the amygdala. And when you think of the amygdala, it's a psychological throw switch. It's like a fire alarm that if you pull it, it's going to shut down. If you pull a fire alarm in a building, it shuts down the electricity. It shuts down the building. Everything shuts down. That's how embarrassment is in the brain. if you're embarrassed to talk to a pretty girl, like you can't even articulate words, if you're embarrassed to speak in front of a crowd, any time embarrassed enters itself into the brain, you cannot do a simple task. And golf is the same way. There's no such thing as a golf swing good enough that a golfer can execute it regularly with the fear of embarrassment. So ego golf, right, the why, leads to the reaction of embarrassment, which leads to the amygdala firing, which creates a physiological arousal, which kills your golf swing. And so you realize the way the dominoes fall, that the why sets off a series of events that you're either going to be a fearless golfer or you're going to play tentative golf with a lot of self-doubt because you're afraid of what people are going to think of you. So going back to the Justin Rose story, and really hundreds of golfers that I've worked with, once we get our why lined up, results happen pretty quickly. Justin Rose won, so 9 years with no wins. He won 21 days after the first time we met, and then he won 10 days after that again. You know, once we got his why lined up, and that's happened 50 times, you know, 50 professional wins for the golfers I've worked with, and a lot of it begins with getting that why lined up and the mastery golf. Like sometimes you could be thinking about pizza and play good golf. Like, how's that? Like, if psychology matters, why is it that I could think about pizza and play golf? Why can I think about, you know, why can Matt Kuchar mentally check out on a golf course, not remember any of his shots and shoot 64? And the reason is because the psychological, the way the dominoes fall goes, psychology, it's your thoughts. And then the physiology changes, right? So if I have a fear-inducing thought, my body creates epinephrine and norepinephrine and cortisol, all these stress hormones. So I have a physiological shift. Well, then those stress hormones bathe my muscles. So my muscles tighten, my capillaries constrict, and I grip the club tighter. Well, all of a sudden it went from psychological to physiological to musculature, where I'm gripping the club tighter, and then I can't set the club properly and I can't release properly, right? I hold it off, which is why the choker's miss is always what?
It's always a block right, or typically a block right for a right-hander, yeah.
Yeah, it's a big block right, that big ballooning block. And again, the psychology changes the physiology, typically shows up in tense muscles and tight grip pressure. So all of a sudden, with the tight muscles and the tight grip pressure, I can't really set the club properly. Mm-hmm. I'm into my downswing, so now I'm stuck. And at impact, I'm too tight to release. So it's that big balloon block. So you see the psychological affects the physiological, which affects the mechanical. And now you've hit a bad shot and you feel embarrassed, going back to ego, which makes all those stress hormones spike even more. So now on the next tee, you're tighter and more afraid. And then you're in the downward spiral. That's right.
Yeah, I mean, Gio was a great one for me because we try and do our research as much as we can on our guests, and we try to know as much as we can. And I read his book before we spoke, and it was just such a light bulb moment with like what he was. I'm sure it's fairly common stuff in sports psychology, but like, I mean, just the idea of doing it for you and not for somebody else, it really has to this day transformed my game, because now I just accept the fact that I'm shit and I don't get embarrassed by it. I just play on and it's fine. But where before I'd go into my pit of rage because I was shit. So it's like, it really helped me. So maybe it'll help other people.
It was like a light bulb. I remember you then spending 25 minutes on the pod explaining how when you cook dinner for your wife and she doesn't say it's particularly good.
No, she has to give me feedback. You've got to give me feedback.
You know, that really hurts your feelings. I'm a Labrador. I need strokes. I need feedback. I need someone to fuss over me and tell me I've been a good boy. But yeah, he's just absolutely super cool. Bruce, other highlights?
Mike Clayton, actually, I think, you know, the stories he had, again, it's just the way, you know, some of these people who have come on our podcast, you can only really describe them as just orators, really, can't you? In every sense of the word, in that they just can really like hold your attention so damn well. And just, you know, even when he was kind of, I say, going off on one, going through a bit of a monologue, it was like, I'm actually captivated, like by what you're saying, and his ability to just cut through all the kind of noise that surrounds maybe some of these big debates. I know he talks about the distance debate and modern technology, and his ability to just cut through all of that and go right to the heart of the matter. And, you know, throwing around of profanities here and there as well, just for emphasis was brilliant.
I think that Mike Clayton, there's a few things I have to talk about Mike Clayton. It's just like, first of all, it was like episode 22. So we weren't like probably as confident as we are now. And the fact that we didn't talk about the putter throw is shocking. Like, how did we not talk about
it? Mike had already talked for the thickest end of 2 hours by this time, to be fair. And I remember him joining the pod and having a shout to his wife, and she's like, he was on there and he didn't know he was on the squadcast, but he was on the squadcast. He was like figuring out how to get it loaded up on his screen or something. And she was like, you're on another podcast. He was like, yeah, some guys in England, something called Cookie Jar or something. But you're right. Yeah. And our naivety showed hugely by the fact that we couldn't get a word in edgeways. And I think a lot of the time we spend most, and you know, maybe we're just more woke than we were now than we were at the start of the year. But I actually be really interested to, I might listen to that one back. In fact,
I went back and listened to it recently because I remember listening to it at the time. And I remember he was talking about Mike Kaiser and then he was talking about Bandon and he was talking about all these different things. And I remember just sitting there nodding, going, yep, just fake this. It's fake that you know what he's talking about.
What do you make
and
it?
You can find out later. And having been through the journey of the cookie jar over the past year and all this stuff, and having gone back and listened to it recently, I actually understand so much more of it now than I did at the time. It was so above my head at the time. It was unbelievable.
You could have probably even though you've never played the old course, you could probably challenge Mike on most of that stuff he was saying, because you've almost you've spent more time talking about the old course for someone who's never played it than anyone else on this planet now, Tom. I mean, you've spent just the strategy on the second hole with Harry from Shore Hill Analytics.
I almost think, I mean, yeah, you guys are both touching it. The word to describe us then was just awestruck. I think the three of us were just so nervous of, like, you know, interrupting his flow and asking a question that maybe wasn't quite on the money, because he was just on an absolute roll, wasn't he? And as you say, Tom, you listen to it back now with the benefit of, you know, a good portion of the last few months has been spent on course architecture and understanding it more through the Story of a Golf Club films and getting to know the kind of world of golf architecture a little bit better. Listen back to it a bit now and I'm kind of like, oh yeah, there's just so much good stuff in there. And it in many ways it really was like a good introduction, a baptism by fire, but still a good introduction into some of these really interesting debates in the game.
Baptism of fire. I think I went down in flames. I was petrified that someone would know that I had no idea what he was talking about. But we have been through a lot in the last year, the last 58 episodes now. And I think one of my favorite stories has to be the D squared David Davis Cypress Point story. It's just absolutely unbelievable. And actually what he failed to mention at the time, was actually the reason that he got on the top 100 panel. So we'll roll the story and then we'll just explain what happened.
I skipped it, and let's say I saved it for last. So it puts everything into perspective for the listeners, because you really do have to be a true fanatic to kind of make this finish, accomplish, or, you know, even want to tackle the top 100 in the world. And when you start, you know, saying you want to tackle it is one thing. And when you start working on it and you see how much effort is into it, it's another. But it's a funny story, and it'll paint a little bit of a picture into what I'm like, I suppose. Back around roughly around 2010, I had an opportunity to play Cypress Point, and I'm going to tell you about that opportunity. And it's a bit of a story, but it's kind of a funny one. So at that stage, I had been divorced from my first wife for several years, and I had I was engaged again, and the young lady I was engaged to was a phenomenal golfer, like one of the best women golfers I've ever played with. So she was from Mexico and two-time national champion, and both times she beat Lorena Ochoa for the national title. Wow. So, and not just that, I mean, you know, I think every guy out there can relate to seeing this really beautiful girl, right? And you think, wow, now imagine seeing this really beautiful girl who has a freaking amazing golf swing. I mean, like 10 times better than your swing, right? And then, you know, the butterflies go from pitter patter to just like full on, oh my God, that's incredible, basically, you know? So anyway, this was that girl. And I had helped her to get a new job, and through her job, her training, it was actually a really good job with this medical instruments company, and her training was going to be in the US in California. And I'd never played golf in California at that stage. And so I was like, that is so cool, because I have friends there. I've been meaning to do this golf trip, you know, this epic golf trip to California, and we'll do it while you're at the training. And it just so happened that she was having her 30th birthday on the weekend in between the training, right? So she was there for 2 weeks. That middle weekend was her 30th birthday. So I said, oh, that's perfect. I'll fly in for your 30th birthday. We'll have a great time in LA, and then I'll fly back out so you can focus on your work and your training and stuff, and I'll finish my golf trip. And then she was like, no, I don't think, nah, that's not a good idea. I'd rather go away when you come back. And I was like, yeah, listen, we can do that too. But this is, you know, this is really cool. And it's a good excuse for me to play this golf. And at this stage, I'm totally full on into wanting to play courses and stuff like that. Right.
Really want to play.
So I really want to play. So I go off on my own and I start to, I'm trying to organize this trip, and all these courses start falling together. So, I mean, I managed to get an invite to Meadow Club and San Francisco Golf Club and Cal Club and Monterey Peninsula Country Club. And so everything's kind of like, you know, all the big ones are falling into this this schedule. I get Riviera, I get LACC. And then finally, I get the call of all calls. So I'm called and I'm offered to go to Cyprus. I mean, this is like, you know, I've literally been dreaming about it, because it's one that I've seen some pictures of, even though I try not to do too much study, but it's always been like number one on the list.
It's pretty much only past presidents remembers, right? That maybe a handful of other people. It's crazy. It's crazy.
Crazy. Yeah. So, and as soon as that happened, I mean, I'm like literally jumping for joy, you know, like as you would, like, yeah, how do I calm myself down? Okay, I got to invite to Cypher. So, you know, I go running in there to say like, okay, listen, you'll never believe what happened. I just got this invite to go to Cyprus or whatever. And she said, oh, are you still talking about this California trip? I thought we already talked about that. I said that I want to focus on my job. I didn't want you to come to this, you know, all this stuff, basically. And you can imagine that my, you know, your state of mind when you got that, because my state of mind is already saying, yeah, yes, absolutely. And so, And she said, so she got really upset basically about this, that I was coming back with this golf thing. I said, listen, I've just received an invite to Cypress Point. And I said, that's a once in a lifetime opportunity. There's no way I just can't pass that up. And so she starts getting upset, and she says, well, you're going to have to choose. And she said,
no.
And she says, you're going to have to choose. You choose. If it's that important to you, you choose Cypress Point or me. And you know what I said?
I've got a feeling.
Pack your bags.
No, you didn't. So the short and long of that story is top 100 heard about this from various people that are involved, and they contacted him and said, if you are willing to do that to your fiance, I think you're willing to be top 100 panel. So unbelievable.
It was the most brutal story, wasn't it? And you could see it happening in slow-mo, couldn't you? I mean, it had absolutely no relevance to the majority of the discussion we'd had with him. So he knew he had it in the chamber, and because we hadn't asked about Cypress Point, which I guess, when you have these guys on, like you can easily chew up time talking about Augusta and Pine Valley and Cyprus. So you know, we talked about Augusta relevance for the Masters, and, you know, Pine Valley had then come up somehow in the conversation. We spent time with that. So I'd consciously not spent ages then, or even mentioned Cyprus, because you want to talk about the other stuff than just three courses on the list. So it got to the end and he was just like, right, guys, I'm going to tell you this story at the end if we're okay for time. And then it was like the ultimate mic drop moment of Cookie Jar Pod, wasn't it? It's like, right, cheers, lads. See you later.
That was £300 worth of mic destroyed.
Where do you go from that?
Obliterated. pod. It was just exploded. I was like, well, that's a soundbite for part two, Dad, anyway.
You boys always poke fun at me, even on the bloody website where it says, you know, without the burden of a wife or long-term girlfriend, Bruce is able to spend more time on his golf. And I listened to David Davis. I'm like, yeah, I feel vindicated now. That's why.
Don't get me wrong, Bruce. No one's saying it because we're angry at you. You know, there's jealousy there. Look, I mean, the lengths. That, I mean, if you can do that, then, you know, fair play to the guy. You know, the guy's not gonna, you don't sit on your deathbed with regrets of what you've done. You sit on deathbed with regrets of what you haven't done, don't you, at the end of the day? And he's all in on this stuff, and all the better for it. Like, he's a super interesting guy. And to be fair, that shows. That was a massively popular pod. That one really blew up. Cool. So many good stories, though. Like, crazy just flicking through those. And when you think most of that's happened in the space of about 10 or 11 months, really.
Yeah, it's been crazy. And, of course, podcasts aren't the only things we've had our little fingers in. We,
What have you had your little fingers in then, Tom?
That sounds awful. Mills.
That's probably the most creepy reference of 2020.
I mean, if anyone was in any doubt as to whether we've gotten better at this whole podcasting thing and our sort of command of deft linguistic flair, and Mills just goes in with an absolute clangor like that. Yeah. 8 months in and we're still tripping over ourselves.
I think that was intentional, creepy little fingers. But the 26th of July was a big date for us. That was Silithon Solway, story of a golf club, which was a big deal for us at the time. It was still a big deal to us now, but it was the first time someone else gave us a chance to go and vlog.
It's easy enough talking to club secretaries now explaining what we do. At the time, when I'm not a videographer on the phone to Alan Oliver at Silithon Solway Golf Club, trying to explain to him that we're willing to drive the thick end of 3.5 hours in a car with a shed load of videography equipment and do this stuff on documenting their story. And he was like, yeah, sounds like a lovely idea, lads. I mean, just let me know when you're on your way up, basically. I mean, it was just bizarre. And I remember, like, I mean, when you think we've just done that Scotland series, we spent most of those, we were to do 8 courses in 5 days. Now, I'm not a YouTube expert. None of us are, for that matter. Tom, you are obviously a videographer, but the people that are doing this for a living are spending 6-7 hours on a course. They're doing one course in a day and they're vlogging the life out of it. And, you know, I think, to be fair, of all the things that we've got to tip our cap to on the pod, I think your production quality that you've helped us with this year, mate, has been absolutely second to none. Like, genuinely, it's world-class stuff. And we are in debt to you. Because a lot of that comes from
far too your kind. Skills.
And that's the only kind thing you're going to get out of me this pod. But the... Where's it going with that? You think these guys are spending all day at one course, right? And we were doing 8 courses in 5 days. We were at Gullen Golf Club for 3 hours and 15 minutes playing a 3-ball. And I think the three of us dropped something like about 6 shots to par in 18 holes off the back tees. Now, that is quick in its own right. And in windy conditions, and we recorded what I think is a world-class piece of videography at the other end of it. Now, Silithon Solway Golf Club was an altogether different setup. You weren't there, Bruce. Let me paint the picture. We've driven up at like 4 a.m. with coffees on the go or something, got there and essentially spent 12 hours running around like lunatics holding cameras and pointing them in every different direction.
No idea what to do. I was just filming everything, literally everything I could see. I was just like, I had no idea what the product was going to be. So I didn't know how to film it. So I was just sort of running around going like, let's just film this, let's film this. We played 36 holes. We got the pro out. We got the manager out for 9 of those holes. Like, we had no idea what we were doing. It was just like, just point and shoot and see what happens. And
it was mad. And I think, and I remember, like, Tom had got his drone up, and I'd not really seen the drone much, to be fair, at this point. And his drone caches to his phone a little bit, or certainly the first few clips generally before the memory goes every like so often. So I remember he was like, oh, here you go, I've got some of these drone things. And I was just like so giddy. I was like running around the club, I was going, Alan, you want to see this drone footage? And he was like, yeah, that's roughly what it looks like from the air. You're right there, Sam. That's good that you're excited by it. Let's see what it's like. And, yeah, look, I mean, yeah, it's cool. Like, I mean, obviously the videography stuff is very popular and people really like it. And And damn right, it's really good stuff. And I think the story of a golf club as an idea seems to have struck a chord with people. Like, it's really good understanding clubs and the history. And, you know, I always liken it to when you stand on the first tee somewhere that you've not played. And if you're not with a member or you're not with anyone who's been there before, you just come off and you just see the 18 holes of golf that you've played. Whereas if you go and play golf with a member, you kind of understand the backstories, don't you?
Yeah, well, you know, definitely. And I think hat tip to you, Sam, because I think we'd all agree that the impetus for the story of a golf club thing really came from you, sort of middle of the year. We'd done some videography on Wolf and on the longest day, the Macmillan stuff, which was great fun. And then you were like, actually, we've got a world-class videographer, you know, in our lineup. Why aren't we doing more of the story of a golf? Why don't we do this concept story of a golf club? I think Silithon Soul would be a great idea. And we were all just like, yeah, sure, that sounds good. But you took it upon yourself to go ahead and organize that. And then I just remember seeing it, you guys sending it through. Sadly, I couldn't make it, and being like, wow, this could be the future of Cookie Jar Golf now. Because it's such a unique way of portraying these clubs and these courses that it seems like not many other people are really doing out there. And yeah, it's so engaging and exciting. I just remember being like, I need to get involved with this now.
It's quite funny because I could tell two little stories here. First of all, I think we can now for the first time openly say why we chose Silithon Solway. We chose Silithon Solway because it was far enough away that if we fucked it up, probably less people would find out.
Well, no one at our home club would realise that we'd gone to try to track down somewhere within a 2-hour circumference, wasn't it? I mean, I knew it was world-class golf course. We knew it was so good that it was going to set up well on camera. And also, you know, it's a good value golf place. Like, it's loopy how much they give golf away for. It's like 60 quid or something in the peak season. Like, it's utterly ludicrous. Mm. So it was like, well, this is almost a risk-free thing because at the very least, we're going to have a good day and we'll have cut our teeth on something. And if it's a hash, then it's a hash. So you're right.
But it's quite funny. I mean,
yeah, risk-free.
I have been doing this full-time for quite a while now. And we did the longest day. And we did this longest day on around about the 2nd of June, where we tried to fit 4 rounds in. And
telegraphed, I can see it coming from 50 yards out.
In daylight. And
here he comes, while hurtling towards me.
While we were doing this, it was, you know, I'll take my camera along, I'll do a little bits and bobs. It was pretty rubbish. It was like, you know, we're trying to fit 72 holes in. It's hard work. Made a little film, a bit gimmicky, a bit rubbish. Hey, boys, what do you think about this? Yeah, it's okay. We finished Silithon Solway. And Bruce turns to Sam, bearing in mind 6 weeks since the longest day, and Bruce gives it. Tom's come a long way since the longest day, hasn't he?
His videography skills have really come on leaps and bounds, haven't they, in that time?
In that 6 weeks.
Nothing to do with the fact you've done it for 6 years professionally. It was just the
Chinese whispers at the cookie jar. Ladies and gentlemen, for anyone who wants an insight into Sam's level of discretion or lack thereof, something
don't start
that was
on
not
your discretion,
quite.
Bruce. Don't you dare start on your discretion.
But actually, to make a somewhat serious point, I'd be interested because I'm totally uneducated on these things, as is Sam, even though he likes to pretend that he can, you know, he's got an eye for all the money shots. What is it like though, Mills, shooting, you know, golf courses and just golf generally? I mean, when you look back at Silith versus, say, our latest film from Scotland, I mean, do you shoot golf? There's clearly an art to like shooting golf that's different to shooting maybe other sports or even, you know, things such as weddings. I mean, how much have you learned, would you say, as a videographer, like over the last few months of doing it?
Oh, yeah, I've learned loads. I mean, it's a different format. It's both of the things I do are live events. They're always live. So it's kind of, you get one shot at it, and if you don't get it, you've lost it. And I've that's something I've dealt with for a long time. I'm now in the position that where we do filming that we can actually do a lot more staging where we sit down and do interviews. Mm. We can light it properly. We can mic them up properly. So that's my education is coming along a little bit there. And when you edit as well, I think when you edit any film that
you learn a lot there. You learn far more in the edit than you do in the field, because you can see what's gone wrong. You can see how you can improve it next time. And we're going to, in the next few weeks, drop the rest of our Scotland films and the second part of the tour film. I've got every faith that the next tour film that we produce will be a degree better than what we've produced, because I've seen ways that what we did could have been improved, and what we did, we were kind of held back by my lack of thought, really. And I think moving forward, the only way is up, really. And I think as long as we keep getting chances to film these, let's be fair, we filmed some absolutely gorgeous golf courses, which really does help the cause, doesn't it?
Yeah, the concept behind it is that we are trying to unearth the best interesting stories from golf courses, and there's a finite amount of where that can be done, right? But, you know, you look at it and it has moved on. Like, I sat there and looked at the Gilhant stuff that you and Tom produced, Bruce, and obviously we sat down and released a podcast with Bruce and interspersed the audio and looked at, you know, some of the construction videos that you got hold of, and it's just like, you know, I say anything that is just almost as close to a masterpiece on YouTube golf videos, which probably doesn't say much again for their overall quality, but it is genuinely a masterpiece. And I think that's like way, way beyond what we produced at Silloth. And I'm really excited about where we'll take that bit next year. Like, I don't want to peek too much behind the curtains for what's to come next year, but we are definitely going to start to do stuff on top of Story of a Golf Club, aren't we? It's fair to say we're going to be looking at stuff that's, you know, maybe it's more people led, maybe it's more event led, maybe it's stuff that's like linked to the game. That I think what we're always trying to do is put a degree of production quality in place that might not be there, and doing stuff with a slightly different angle targeted at our market. So, you know, the idea isn't to bash the Peter Finches or the Rick Shields of the world, but offer something that is maybe a little bit more niche and a bit more, you know, maybe a bit more in depth than maybe some of those guys jump into.
No, I think it's important we grow and diversify and do a lot of other things. And if you guys, you know, listening, got any ideas for us, please do get in touch on @CookieJarGolf. But I think it's safe to say that
on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
And YouTube and Facebook and Twitter
other bloody
and Instagram
platform, TikTok,
and,
you name it.
But don't get us on Grindr. We're not there just yet. Cookie Jar isn't the only thing to happen in 2020. Of course, we've had the professional game, and I thought it'd be interesting if we could sort of touch on, you know, our highlights or our personal favorite stories or things that have gone on in 2020 in the professional game. So, Sir Bruce, what do you think?
Yeah, I sound like a broken record here, but going back to what I said at the start of the pod and how weird this sort of time warp seems to be that we're living in, that is 2020. I mean, thinking back to Azinger, just all the fury he caused about the PGA Tour and the utter tripe that he was spouting about Tommy Fleetwood not being able to keep it together, and then
February
winning the next week. I mean, that seems from a different decade, doesn't it, though?
Yeah.
Yeah, seems from a different decade, that does. So, yeah, to talk about that in the same breath as DJ winning the Masters and Bryson's whole distance quest that really accelerated and bore fruit with his US Open win. And, of course, Sofia Popov, which for me is probably, you know, the best story in the professional game this year. It's because it's all so spread out and punctuated by these long absences. It's just tough to get a handle on it all, really, and offer some general perspective, I think.
Well, isn't it weird to think that pretty much, so this has been recorded on December 28th, pretty much a year ago plus a week was the whole Patrick Reed thing with the shovel. I mean, that seems like ages ago.
It's like different lifetime stuff, isn't it? Like, that and I seem to remember we were still dining out on that for like episodes 1 through 7 in lieu of any substantial content to talk about.
Yeah.
But that was like for a year, like Jesus Christ, like that's like not even newsworthy. It's weird you mentioned Sofia Popov as well, Bruce, because that was on my list as well. And like some of that stuff. But I mean, you're itching to come in here, Bruce. I can see hands waving at me. Like, what's in your head?
Well, no, I just, if you'll indulge me for a moment, I remember getting on the plane to go to South Africa just after the Genesis had concluded that Adam Scott had won. And I think we covered that, didn't we? We maybe covered the final round on the Sunday when it looked like Rory was going to win because he obviously started with, I think, maybe a healthy two-shot lead. And then Adam Scott came kind of tearing through, and we covered that. And then I'm there waiting to get on a plane to South Africa, and I see Gareth Lord in the airport lounge, and I say, guys, I think I might be able to get our first podcast guest here. And I had a lovely chat with him about, you know, Justin struggling a little bit, not playing his best at Riviera, and then just getting absolutely ghosted by him on email for the next 2-3 weeks.
You got on the plane and said, here's Gareth Lord's number, just in case this flight goes down. We've got it for posterity. Like, if this flight goes down, presumably Gareth Lord's in it as well. I didn't quite follow that part. But yeah, like...
No, he's on a different flight.
But he lived in Monaco, and you track the numbers through our platform, and you can see, fucking hell, it's lighting up. We're getting listens in Monaco all of a sudden. Like, this, like, he's definitely into it. So maybe he'll reply to at least one of the 50 messages that Bruce has sent him in the last sort of day and a half. But it appeared not. And that was fucking weird, wasn't it? Like, but, I remember that, like, clear as day.
But the key part of this story, yeah, was I obviously got really excited and got into a bit of a tiz there, saying, oh, you know, had a great chat with him. And we did have a really, you know, nice chat in the airport. I'm sure he just thought, who's this giddy guy with a big head who, you know, cares far too much about golf. And I think the real issue, though, was that he then said, oh, listen to the Cookie Jar podcast. I've got it downloaded here on the phone for the flight back to Monaco from London. Thanks very much. And I then walked away and you know, obviously relayed this to Sam and Tom, and then said about 2 minutes later, oh, shit, I think the episode he's downloaded is the one where we bash Justin Rose. Can you check that, please, Tom? And I think it was
that's 20 minutes of the pilot gone.
Wasn't it? Where you said, Tom, you said, I'll give you a clue to who this golfer is. It was some, you know, question and guessing game or whatever. I'll give you a clue to who this golfer is, Sam. He's a poor man's Luke Donald. It's Justin Rose. And then, yeah, I mean, maybe we shouldn't be surprised we never heard from Lordy after that.
So strange we didn't hear back from him. So bizarre.
The benefit of hindsight. Moving on from our gas and maybe on to other people's. Highlight for the year, it's got to be Bernhard Langer shooting a lower score round Augusta than Bryson. Like, you could see it happening in the lead up to that event, couldn't you? And
It was too much pressure.
It was really boring. Like, do you remember there was like a 6-hour rain delay? And I remember Bruce sort of cheekily remarked, maybe we'll be able to cut to it, in fact. But he said in a post-masters pod, you know, I actually got on with my life for 6 hours while the rain was coming down. I sat there and watched and thought, Jesus, they are overdoing the Bryson chat so much here. You could see him blown up. But, I mean, you've got to take your hat off to Langer, haven't you? I mean, for a guy of his age, he's hitting 3 woods in where most of these boys were hitting 9-irons and pitching wedges. And that is an absurdly good score. And that was nice to see. So I think that was part one. I think sort of leading on to that, was also seeing Jimenez kind of breaking records again as well, and with in terms of appearances and stuff like that. And it just felt like there was a couple of nice parts of the second half of the year. There was a few good victory laps for some of the mainstays.
Well, Westwood, mate.
Yeah, I haven't even mentioned Westwood.
I can't believe that. Yeah, it was all leading up to that, and you've just completely.
No, I don't think Westwood has passed it. Maybe Jimenez, but you know, you put him in that camp by all means. I mean, Westwood, Langer, and Jimenez. You know, you've written all three of them off there in one fell swoop now, Bruce.
No, hang on. No, I wrote you off for not mentioning, you know, when you're discussing a tale of kind of wisdom and experience rising to the top in a disrupted year, and you failed to mention Lee Westwood becoming the oldest winner of the Race to Dubai, or the European Tour Order of Merit, depending on how you categorize it. Just pointing that out. But then again, I'm sure we could go back to an early pod.
I've been singing his praises all year.
Well, the Westwood was weird, isn't it? Just if we touch on it, because we haven't done a podcast since. The fact that, you know, Laurie Cantor and Matt Fitzpatrick were up there sort of jostling for it and jousting. And, oh, you know, Fitz
took the lead on the last round and stuff. But that cataclysmic explosion by Cantor, which basically just was throwing away shots for fun, basically lost his career earnings to date in that sort of dropping off of shots as he kind of went down the stretch, is what handed Westwood the title, because he needed solo position of second, and Cantor would have quite comfortably, if he just sort of, you know, even if he'd bogeyed in, I think he would have tied second.
He'd have cantered into second, wouldn't he, really?
Laurie, if you do want to come on the pod at any time, I will give you a very nice sort of interview. I'm nowhere near as harsh as Mills is there.
That's not harsh. I'm just stating facts.
Well, you're still naive, Bruce. You haven't done as many guest pods as me and Tom, to be fair. So
Sophie Ridge on Sky now.
When you say cataclysmic explosion, I mean, he just hit a bad chip into the grain on 17, really, didn't he? I mean, we've all been there.
Bad approach shot on 17, then bad chip, and then he putted up, and it was like, and then he had that approach on 18, which was out of this world, right? But managed to get a drop off the stands, didn't he? So I managed to get his par that way. But I mean, it just sort of looked like sort of headed come off. But I mean, the stage is enormous. Who are we to talk about the pressure these boys are under? The stage is absolutely incredible. And the money is
quite surprising, though, as well, in a year where you're not allowed spectators. There's been so many gaffes with hoardings and infrastructure that have actually got in the way of playing. Mm. I mean, do you remember this is very close to being almost on par with Tom Mills's what's the ladies' version of the Ryder Cup or the ladies' Ryder Cup gaffe.
Never said what's.
But was it the ladies' PGA, women's PGA, where they were playing, I can't remember the name of the course, and they put an enormous backboard.
Yeah. It wasn't the PGA because that was a Aronimit, but it was that one with an island green where they were just, yeah.
It was a huge event.
Someone decided to try and bring a basketball theme. Maybe it was the ShopRite or something, but they were like, yeah, let's bring a basketball theme to golf and get people pinging 5-wood off the backboard.
Yeah.
Mental.
Crazy. And it culminated with a chip in, which forced a playoff and actually, you know, my somewhat flaky understanding and knowledge of the women's professional game is probably going to show here. I can't remember the person's name, but that was a pivotal moment, wasn't it, in terms of that. It's weird, just funny how in a year where there are no spectators, that could have such a big bearing. The other highlight I've put down here, I know it's not professional golf related, but I'm just going to deviate slightly from your kind of question there, Tom, is just the increase in participation. Like, that has got to be a massive good news story from this year.
Yeah.
You know, UK were up 27%. It's the same story in the States. It's the same pretty much worldwide. That's a massive, massive win for golf. Like, it suffers so badly with its image and never seems to get it right. And the fact that tee sheets are absolutely chock-a-block on pretty much any golf course. And I think that's
But that's not the problem though, isn't it? I mean, the problem is now the golf has got the onus of keeping these people engaged, and tee sheets are just getting stacked up, and people are, you know, getting to. It's, I know coronavirus is an issue, and they've got to spread people out. Sometimes it's two balls only and things like that. But when people have got to sort of ration to one round a week or two rounds a week, it's going to be a problem for golf to try and keep hold of those people. And that's the problem that's going to have to be tackled next, isn't it?
I don't know. I mean, how many clubs suffer with that problem though, really? I mean, maybe I'm just playing devil's advocate here, but I don't know if there are loads of golf clubs where the tee sheets are absolutely rammed out, or maybe more than that, you know, we've played in a few, what we maybe say, traditional kind of golfing circles this year where people like to play fast. And I think for growing the game, you know, the obsession on 2.5 hour to 3 hour rounds is unnecessary, because actually it's such a hard sport to learn. You're going to be taking like north of 4 hours when you first take this game up. And if people are willing to commit that time to it, then brilliant, more power to them. That's what we need to get people into the game. I just think, you know, the great strength of golf is that we can have a huge range of clubs that cater to all abilities and all tastes when it comes to how much competitive golf they want to play, how long they want to take, what they want to wear. I'm fully in the court, same court as you, Sam. I think, you know, it's one of the few good things to come out of the pandemic is more people playing golf, because, you know, it's one of the few sports that you can play socially distanced.
No, I'm completely in agreement. I think it's absolutely fantastic. I just really hope that we manage to keep hold of them. I mean, one of the losers of this, of course, is new formats of golf, like golf sixes. These formats that are designed to get people engaged and get them in and out in the course and off the course in a short amount of time, and they can fit it around their work. And obviously, with everything that's gone on, these experimental formats have kind of gone out the window. So hopefully, maybe next year we'll get a few more of those things involved and try and keep more people involved in the game.
Mm. Well, I mean, here's hoping, like you say, the onus is on the game to keep people engaged. I think there's a lot. I mean, I wouldn't be too dismissive on it, Bruce. There are definitely a lot of clubs, certainly the kind of, you know, I don't know how best to say it, but, you know, the entry-level golfer is playing, you know, more casual golf clubs. And some of those places are, you know, absolutely full to the brim. They're over the numbers, and dare I say, in the UK, a lot of them aren't open all year round. So it's bloody hard. Like, I mean, it was really like, I had loads of mates who hardly ever lift a club. I think I told you boys about it this week when we were out playing a few holes, who barely lifted a club, who were absolutely itching to get out there in the summer. My phone's not been as red hot during December and November when we've been in similar predicaments. So let's see. But either way, it's a massive, massive good news story. And there's been so much other stuff, hasn't there? I mean, like, you know, Christ, recent highlights, seeing Tiger and his son Charlie out playing, and there's just been some incredible kind of, like, themes that have cut throughout the year. And like, I think you said it, Bruce, you know, some of the things that have happened have almost sort of punctuated different periods in the year when there's been so many sort of long breaks.
So there's a couple of news stories that are probably worth mentioning just to sum up our 2020. First question, quick fire question. Is it fair that Phil Mickelson is allowed to compete on the Champions Tour? Like, it's basically just walking into the bank, holding up a gun and saying, give me all your money, thank you, I'm off. It's just,
I mean, if the rumours are to be believed, I think Phil probably needs to earn a good crust on Champions Tour.
Okay. Oh, here we go.
Okay.
I'm just saying, rumours. You've got to have conjecture in this pod. Come on. It's a key part of the product. But I think, yeah, like, it's got to be a victory lap, hasn't it? I mean,
if he's just like, he's still... Do you want
a little factoid about Phil?
Yeah, there, isn't he? Go for it.
Never been world number one. How about that?
No.
That's right. Really?
Yeah.
Never, I mean, I suppose it doesn't because of the...
Because of the Tiger.
Time, yeah. But
the Tiger effect.
That's nuts. I mean, yeah, I mean, he's going to clear up, though, isn't he, on the Champions Tour? He's hitting it big. I still remember that
how
time
dominant
they played
had
it.
He been, though? I know he won the first one, but how dominant has he been?
He won his first two.
Did he win the first two?
We'll have to check this out.
I mean, it's an ominous start, isn't it?
Stats.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, he's got a... I mean, I still remember them playing at Medalist. Do you remember when it's pouring down rain? That was actually of all those... That, in fact, should have gone in the highlights for the professional game with some of those exhibition matches, because the one they played that looked really cool, I thought, on paper, was probably the most boring, like Seminole, where they had, I think it was it was the TaylorMade boys, wasn't it? It was Wolfie, Rory, DJ, and...
Ricky Fowler.
They were obviously not complete tailor-made staffing lineup, but they were they're playing. That was just felt very dry. Yeah. It wasn't really engaging. And then when you were watching Tiger and Phil playing in the rain with, was it Peyton Manning and
Brady?
Yeah. That was actually quality entertainment. And Phil driving up after he took on that par four, and he was just in his buggy going, long, nasty, salty bombs.
Yeah, it was way more enjoyable. I mean, watching Tom Brady hit some absolutely vicious shanks and kind of shots was like, yeah, you know what? I want that kind of like visceral feeling of unease and just anxiety.
It was horrible to watch, wasn't it? And then he drained it in that 1/3.
Yeah. Yeah, and then you've got that juxtaposed with Tiger just putting on a clinic and Phil going in and out. And you compare that to TaylorMade's driving relief thing, which was just a bit of a damp squib, wasn't it, really? I think that was one of that was the subject of some of our most cutting commentary on the pod, wasn't it, when we're talking about Paul Azinger in a suit that still had the hanger still in it, you know, with kind of briefing documents out there as if he's about to invade Iraq, talking about how Matt Wolf's just hit a drive that's carried 320 and he's gonna, you know, overcook the analysis on it. Yeah, I mean,
not to pat my own back, but Phil Mickelson has only played two Champions Tour events and he won them both. As a 750 grand total, 403.50 were his winnings. So that goes somewhat to clearing the debt, some would think.
Well, I don't know about debt, but it's definitely some good gambling coupons. Can we move on to close this up? I'm thinking some year-end appraisals might be quite nice.
Okay. Mm. I've never sat in an appraisal. I've never had a job. So why don't you appraise, boss?
Okay. I mean, I'll kick it off and just point straight at you, Bruce. And we'll try and keep this short and punchy, but...
Yeah, this is right up the alley of Mr. Corker himself.
So just tell me about your year in terms of your personal contribution to the cookie jar, Bruce. What's kind of – give me a flavour for how it's gone and what your kind of big successes in the year have been personally.
Wow, there you go. In the hot seat. Yeah, I mean, I think to begin with just trying to find my feet and not sound like a complete tool on the podcast and try and, you know, add some kind of intonation to my otherwise pretty flat, low flying bomber of a voice was a big success for me early on. And, you know, gradually kind of learning the ropes of professionalism. I remember I got reprimanded quite fairly by yourself during the Iona Stephen pod when I looked up Tom Watson and the year he won the Open, or the sorry his age when he won the Open, and just, you know, trying to avoid kind of minor gaffes like that, and then really, you know, getting to a stage where I could sort of shoot from the hip a little bit more and not maybe take myself so seriously and kind of get more towards Tom Mills's level of just firing into people and swinging through the saloon doors, as it were.
No, and I think it's, you're naturally, you know, you're a humble person and you're already starting to talk about some of your development areas there, Bruce. But, you know, I think certainly our listeners can see this year that you've brought a level of kind of insight that some of the other heathens, as you referred to them, have probably not throughout the year. So I think bravo to you. In terms of your development areas, you've already touched on there, maybe some of our listeners have said, is he just the show pony for the videos? Like, do we just wheel you out as having a sort of a pornographic swing that looks good on camera? You know, you've talked about that. Is he just kind of there because he's a high quality amateur golfer who happened to have won the President's Putter? Christ, that didn't even make the highlight reel, did it? This year, to be fair, it has had
within 2019.
It's 2020, right in January, and it has had an amount of time, to be fair. But in terms of your development areas, Bruce, where are you looking to sort of really focus on going into 2021? What are you hoping to work on?
Well, I think the show pony swing still needs some tightening up. You know, it's probably a little bit short and I get a little bit too draw biased. You know, looking at the Castle Stewart video, sort of started a bit too far right on that first hole.
Sorry, Bruce, just for a change. Sorry, Bruce, we're not talking about your golf. We're talking about your contribution to Cookie Jar here.
We're not talking about the swing.
Absolutely fine. It's your year-end appraisal. We can talk about whatever you'd like, but I'm thinking in terms of your contribution to the pod.
I really am getting the sense you're teeing me up for something here and you boys have colluded prior to us
going
on air.
No, I haven't. I'm just running a corporate year-end appraisal. You said you want me to host the year-end appraisal, so that's what I'm doing.
Okay, how about you tell me where I need to approve then? Because I know you've got something loaded in the chamber here, Sam. You always like
no,
to come
I genuinely
prepared to these
haven't.
Things.
The nature of working in a corporate business is you have to coach things. You can never tell people the answers. It's so much more impactful when you give us the answers. So all I was looking for is you to tell me what you bring into the party next year.
Okay. Well, I think I know what you're getting at. You know, obviously I can get a little bit sort of fiddly with my diet, and I think going forward when we've got early morning filming commitments, I'm probably going to cut out shellfish. to avoid any kind of food poisoning that maybe stops me getting there for the early drone shots. I know you didn't believe me. I know you don't.
I had nothing in the chamber.
You don't believe me that I had some sort of double trouble, which meant I couldn't get to the Berkshire on time for that sort of 5 a.m. meet.
Asymptomatic food poisoning.
Someone has got to sit middle
cut,
of the road.
Cut out the shelf.
Someone's got to be judge, jury, executioner on this one. When we were filming at the Berkshire, I got a call from Bruce, who claimed he had a case of food poisoning, which weirdly seemed to affect his vocal cords, almost like when you get someone who rings in sick for the day. And then he turned up and played 36 holes of essentially level par golf, eating sausage roll and black coffee on repeat all day. And it was the first case of asymptomatic food poisoning I had ever seen in my life. That wasn't where I was going, Bruce. I need you to know that I'm running a fair year-end corporate...
He's got a guilty conscience.
Corporate year-end appraisal. There was no loaded question. And if I'm being honest, you know, I have canvassed views of some of our listeners and tried to sort of get a bit of a sense as to where did you see Bruce's contribution. And people really like your integrity. I think your insight is spot on. They love your swing on camera. They want to see more of it. They want to see more completed swings, less kind of abbreviated backswings. And they want to see you kind of run front and center on a few trips for us next year. And I think otherwise it's been a really good sort of 9.75 out of 10 this year. So well done, mate.
I'm just going to step in for a moment as the person who controls the editing. I feel it's my duty to stitch Bruce up just once with this little snippet of what he did this year.
Yeah, and you know what, Sal? Like, I agree with what you say there. The golfing world's gone nuts. So one-dimensional how much everyone talks about distance. We're obviously not doing ourselves any favor by continuing to talk about distance now, but it is a hilarious soundbite, so we will carry on doing so. But you can take issue with how much everyone dedicates in the way of airtime to the distance debate and Bryson hitting the ball further and McIlroy then putting up his flight scope numbers to try and hit the ball further and DJ doing the same. That's fine. You can take issue with all of that. The problem really is when Matt Fitzpatrick says it's not skill to put on 40 yards, because obviously that's just totally untrue. And I'll tell you what, it actually, to me, it almost smacks of like when Ben Hogan said towards the end of his career that putts should count as half strokes. It's like, have you fucking lost your mind, mate? That's an absolute... Do you know what I mean?
And that's our soundbite.
And that's what I see here. But that's what I see here with Matt Fitzpatrick. It's like, yeah, it's annoying. We get it. People don't want to just keep... You know, other pros don't want to hear about their colleagues and how well they're playing, how far they're hitting the ball. But don't say something fucking insane like, it's not a skill to put on 40 yards, because clearly it is.
So thank you for that, Bruce.
I thought that was a good point. I'm going to continue my year-end appraisal now and just turn my attention to you, Tom. So give us a sense as to, I mean, exiting 2020 with quite a heavy backlog on your workflow. I think it's suffice to say me and Bruce don't have the same commitments in terms of editing that you've had. How are you feeling kind of going into next year?
Well, I'm in the wonderful position where I probably have been called the diva of the podcast. I take criticism pretty poorly. And I've nearly got it to the stage where I want it, which is you're just too afraid to say anything, which is is brilliant. And I just get to do what I want. And I'm nearly there. I think I've got to work on Brucey a little bit. He's still got a few opinions which I need to beat out of him. But going into 2021, I would like to get better in the vlogging. I'd like to be a better vlogger.
What do you mean by that? Sorry, what do you mean by that?
I feel like I made a few silly mistakes this tour in equipment and in how we were going to do it, but life's a learning curve. We'll get better next time. I want to be a better presenter next year. I want to do less of the ums, which I tend to do a lot when I talk on a podcast. And I want to be able to solicit good guests and good advice from your fine selves.
Yeah, no, I think you make some brilliant points there, Mills. I mean, you know, who could deny that you are the sort of the technician of the pod and the man who delivers content on a weekly, if not daily basis for our listeners. I think, you know, if I'm being brutally honest, when we hop on these videos, I think you know, your dress sense maybe sometimes is kind of left wanting a little bit. We can't really forget the Jason Derulo hat that you decided to sport in one of the first pods, which was kind of pulled so low over the face, the peak was basically hiding your eyes, made it very difficult.
It looked
difficult
like something out of a Black
Eyed
Peas video, didn't it? It was outrageous.
Yeah. Sid Matthew nearly signed off when he saw that.
I also had the problem of creating a montage of a Scotland tour film. We were there for 5 days, and only when I got back and edited it did I realize I wore the exact same clothes for 5 days straight. Except they're just
a lot of three people different asked pairs. About your penchant for burgundy trousers, I must admit.
Three different pairs of maroon trousers and the same gilet doesn't really work out well on film.
So a lot of our listeners probably won't know about your diva-ish qualities, will they, Tom? But I think it is fair to say that a product is produced, it's consumed internally, and it's run through robust corporate governance before it even sees the light of day. And sometimes there are some amendments that are just fine tunings, but, you know, people are becoming fearful within the jar for asking for those edits. And I think, you know, clearly some of that diva-ish nature that you bring to the table, as much as it that kind of artistic flair helps us, I think we're gonna have to sort of break down some barriers.
A committee of one. It only needs a committee of one.
You just need a benevolent dictator, which is really, as I see, my role within this pod, which is really to stand in front of it, take the victory laps, and
well, let's flip this round. What do you think about your role in 2020? How it's evolved, and where you see your role moving forward?
I mean, it's very much like my school report, isn't it? It's kind of Sam would do better for thinking first, talking second. It's probably the best way I could summarize.
He's got two ears and one mouth.
Yeah.
Use them in that quantity.
Taken straight from the word of Malcolm Duck.
Oh, yeah. When we had our dinner with Malcolm Duck on tour, and he had to sit Sam down and tell him he's got two ears and one mouth, and to use them in that quantity was, you'd only met him about 2 hours ago.
I don't even think I was actually talking that much. This is when Bruce was on his woke agenda. Let's not spin it though. I think that's clearly one of my many foibles. I mean, look, I'm an optimist. So what am I brought to the party? I think I guess kind of a bit of proactivity, I'd like to think. So I'm pretty happy with. I feel like I'm been pretty proactive. I sort of run that social media with a bit of. I mean, with a degree of control freakishness that's probably unwarranted, but I am pretty anal on it. I'm pretty diligent on trying to get guests and people on the pod. I think that's been a pretty strong suit. I think I've also got a relatively keen eye for some good opportunities, and that's borne fruit this year with things like Cleve Hill, which are projects I think we've all collectively really enjoyed being involved in, and that's been a pretty interesting story. I think that, as always, again back to my sort of school report when I was 10 years old, Sam can be really effective when he channels himself effectively, but he needs to learn to temper his enthusiasm, which can sometimes border into destruction and excitement at times. And I think I mean, I'd do well after probably 34 years of receiving that advice to maybe take heed eventually.
I think that I've never sat in an appraisal, and I've never tried to coax information out of people. So I'll just tell you straight. You don't need to ask how good the last golf shot was. You don't need to ask what a good idea that was to go to Cleve Hill, or you don't need to say, have I done okay today? Do you think this is okay? I'm nearly as good as Bruce, aren't I? Just trust that you are nearly good as Bruce. Trust that you are doing the right things, and just move on.
Yeah, I think there's probably some truth in that. Bruce, have you got a sort of a rebuttal on any of this? Are you just going to, I mean, now's your opportunity to take dead aim.
Take dead aim, yeah, absolutely.
Scott-free on the Berkshire for ringing in sick.
Taking dead aim is one of your sort of favourite, one of the favourite sort of taglines that I associate with you. Another one actually would be, is that okay there? Which I think came up. Well, it's come up several times, but most notably, I think, when we were playing Castle Stewart on the second hole, which is kind of uphill and into the sunlight, it was playing almost semi-blind. And when you sort of shout after you kind of your ball is maybe 1 second off the club face and we're playing a course that none of us have ever seen before, and you've hit this shot that looks like it's heading towards the sea, but you've decided to ask the question anyway of all of us, is that okay there? Just screaming for someone to tell you that your ball's going to be all right. So yeah, maybe in the same theme as Mills, it would just be to back yourself. But yes, absolutely 100% agree with how great you've been on the proactivity, or being proactive, I should say, and how many fantastic ideas you've had. I must admit, I was a little skeptical when you mentioned the Cleve Hill video and said, we're going to try and get the local MP on the line and maybe put a petition before Parliament. And although we maybe didn't hit those giddy heights, I mean, what a stroke of genius going down to Cleve Hill. Well,
we've got
and
Nick Faldo around the course. And
amazing story.
And I think we should definitely... Yeah, we should definitely recap on that. I mean, that is, you've got, I think, you know, I remember a few days later answering the phone to, you know, Matt Faldo, obviously inquiring off the back of Nick. And, you know, we've had people involved from, you know, other architectural firms offering their services. And my understanding is that, you know,
Radio Gloucester.
Yeah, well, Radio, obviously huge. We'd actually had National Club Golfer and stuff cover it. I remember I joined podcast as a guest, actually, on behalf of Cookie Jar with National Club Golfer. But, you know, now there was a glut of bids that came in around that time. And, you know, clearly, as the self-promoter of the group, I'd say there's a connection. And otherwise, it, you know, ultimately, it was a really good opportunity that people started to look at. And I think... the good news is it looks like it will be saved, and I think there'll be an announcement as to who the new incumbent will be at Cleve Hill in by the end of January. So I think that's really exciting.
Oh, I mean, together with the Cleve Hill Facebook group, I think you've really, really worked wonders there. It's mainly the Cleve Hill Facebook group, but the video that you know too is fantastic.
Claws away. That's definitely something that we're going to look forward to for 2021. There's plenty that we plan on doing for 2021. And if you have any additional appraisals or any additional things to add, please do contact us at Cookie Jar Golf on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, or YouTube. But until then...
Bruce and Sam would love to hear your appraisals. Obviously, Mills has just said that he doesn't like hearing any feedback, but you can send two over.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Just those two, just... don't worry about me. I'm already perfect.
Well, Sam Mann marks the social media channel. So if people send it to me in confidence, I can think about how we frame it. I'm happy to anonymize it. You know, provided we do that, there's no concern about recourse from Tom. You know, we will shoulder the burden front and center.
Until then, have a very, very happy new year. And we look to seeing you in bigger and better things in 2021. Goodbye.
Watch this.
Goodbye.